Behind every successful business, there is someone with a vision willing to take chances to make that vision a reality. But since it's still in its infancy, the internet is the perfect space for someone with a good idea who doesn't want to wait to be told how to implement it. In a book called Without Their Permission, How the 21st Century Will Be Made, Not Managed, Alexis Ohanian, the co-founder of the popular website Reddit, shares the stories behind the creation of the news-sharing social media site that is currently visited by 70 million users a month. His book also serves as a how-to guide for young entrepreneurs and makes a strong case for the internet as a vehicle for social good, or, as he puts it, making the world suck less. I'm very pleased to welcome Alexis Ohanian to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me, Leonard.
For the less tech-savvy listeners in our audience, can you tell us about Reddit?
Absolutely.
How does it work?
Well, Reddit is a platform for any online community to share links and have discussions about whatever they want. It could be a community of people speaking on a forum about the Brooklyn Nets. It could be a bunch of New Yorkers talking about the city. It could be a bunch of Virginia Tech students talking about their university and sharing links.
Well, a number of services have been made available, and they don't go anywhere. What did you do to get people to even pay attention?
Wow. You know, Steve Huffman and I had just graduated from UVA, and we moved up to Boston. And this was 05, so Facebook was still in colleges. There was no Twitter. So much of social media didn't even exist. And at first, we just asked our friends, and we went through those friends pretty quickly. And about two of them actually helped out. And as for the rest, it was simply just a matter of finding users wherever we could and reaching out to them online, just using these tools to get an audience.
And unlike the creation of Facebook, there was nobody out there claiming you stole their idea?
No. It was pretty clear cut. In fact, unlike Facebook, it took Steve and I quite some time to get anyone to even care about Reddit. In fact, fun fact, it was 6 months before any major news organization, blog, publication even wrote about Reddit, and it was The Guardian, of all places. So it was a British newspaper that was the first one to actually notice what we were doing.
And they probably learned about it through sifting through NSA records.
You know, I don't think they had those documents back then, but they have been rather on point over the last 10 years, that's for sure.
You say that your strong feelings about the right to free speech influenced your concept of Reddit.
To some extent. I mean, I was inspired taking a semester in London during my sophomore year of college. And I remember going to Speaker's Corner. Now, obviously, London,
Hyde Park.
Yes, in Hyde Park. Now, obviously, one of the great things that came out of our revolution was a Bill of Rights, which, unfortunately, our friends in England don't quite have. But what was so amazing there was you could see literally people on soapboxes talking about whatever they wanted. And I thought, how interesting. This was actually in the run-up to the Iraq War in 2003. And it was fascinating to see, you know, an Iraqi man on a soapbox talking about how terrified he was of the prospect of going to war, debating another Iraqi man on a soapbox talking about how important it was to get. It was seeing that right in front of me that got me thinking and got me really excited about what the internet could do to allow people to have their own soapbox.
Well, we used to have soapbox speakers in Union Square Park, mm-hmm. but that kind of ended at a certain point. And I've been surprised that we haven't seen mass movement around what's been going on in Washington recently. Do you think that the internet has kind of changed all of that? We would not have the kinds of marches we had during the Vietnam War these days because the internet would be a vehicle for that kind of protest?
Well, you know, when I think back to the – okay, I obviously wasn't alive. But when I think back to the protests against Vietnam, you know, there is a – when there is a draft, that's a very easy way to get a bunch of people upset and out on the streets. That was rather exceptional. I think we can't give too much credit to this technology because, of course, people do all this. You know, the Arab Spring was not caused by Twitter. It was just sort of accelerated and helped by it as a communication platform.
Well, how do you deal with issues of authenticity? Isn't every day April Fool's Day on the internet?
That, you know, on my most optimistic days, I think it encourages us to be more skeptical. But, you know, it's a challenge. It has always been a challenge, regardless of whether you're reading it in a official, I'm putting this in air quotes, newspaper, or whether you're reading it online. But we do absolutely need to have that healthy bit of skepticism.
Well, you advise other startups. So I'm sure you've thought of why so many internet startups fail.
Yeah, you know, as I'm now an investor in about 80 of them, and through Y Combinator advise hundreds more. Most often, the reason why startups fail is simply just because they haven't made something people want, and it seems very obvious. But something that you know I really focus on in the book is that the advantage is you can try, you can create with so few barriers, you can get an idea out in the world so easily now that you should be trying to fail. I mean, obviously, don't aspire to fail. But you should be trying because failing is the way you're going to be learning.
Well, also, failing, the possibility of failure means you're just not imitating somebody else.
There is so much truth to that. One of my favorite quotes is that we are standing on the shoulders of giants, and I absolutely believe that. And one of the things that I hope this book and my slightly crazy 75 university college tour will do is encourage a whole other generation of creatives, of entrepreneurs, of people to just try, to just do stuff.
Did you have a model in mind, an online company that you felt was especially successful?
Wow. I mean, it runs the gamut. One of my favorite stories would have to be the founding of Dropbox. And I remember Drew Houston. This is now a multi-billion-dollar company. And I remember Drew, he was there in Y Combinator, working on a dead-end SAT prep company. And one day at South Station, waiting for a bus, he left his thumb drive and he couldn't work on his company. So he thought, there's got to be something better. And so on a bus, literally on a Chinatown bus heading to New York, he started working on what is today a billion-dollar company. No other industry in the world, no other platform has ever allowed such value creation, such growth to come from such humble beginnings.
You've mentioned Y Combinator a few times. Mm-hmm. What is their role in the creation of startups?
Well, they are, you know, Steve and I were very lucky because we were in the first round of Y Combinator. Every 6 months, a batch of startups, usually wide-eyed founders like me, fresh out of college, but not always, come in and spend 3 months living off of a small investment of somewhere between $15,000 and $20,000. It's basically a grad student stipend. Just live for the summer, pay for pizza, pay for some internet bills, and build. And they have created the model for what is now known as like seed stage venture capital. All that is investing a little bit of money in a few founders who you believe can create the next big thing.
So that was where you got most of your seed money?
Yeah. You know, it's easy to get caught up in the headlines. But even back in 2005, Steve and I, we ended up raising $82,000. That was it. We didn't even need to – we realized the way we rationalized it was, you know, we were living fine as college students with just pizza in the fridge. So why do we need to pay ourselves a salary? And it's tidbits like that. You know, it's so easy to look at Reddit today. And yes, I'm very proud of this. There are more people using Reddit every month than live in the entire country of France. But it didn't start that way. It started out with two guys in an apartment in Medford, Massachusetts, eating a lot of hummus and just trying to create and making a lot of mistakes.
Well, how soon after the two of you founded it did you wind up selling Reddit to Condé Nast?
16 months.
It was not long at all.
No.
So it had taken off that much that Condé Nast thought this would be a good investment for us?
Yeah. And what was so remarkable about that was it's so much happened in there, and I'm not going to – the folks can read about it. So much happened during that period, and it was so – I've already felt so lucky to have had all the privileges that I've had to even get to the point where I could be, you know, doing what I was doing. And then to have the opportunity to have my life changed and Steve's life changed with this acquisition, it was just amazing. And what is so remarkable is the site actually continued to keep growing. A lot of acquisitions usually end – pretty poorly. You know, AOL, Time Warner, we can go down the list of failed acquisitions and mergers, but this actually worked out really well. And, you know, I can take very little credit for that in recent years.
MySpace, another example.
Oh, goodness. Yes. I mean, the list goes on, right? And so, you know, credit to Condé Nast for giving us enough freedom. And today, you know, Reddit has been spun off as its own company. And, you know, in the last couple of years, since I have left being full time there, it's actually grown tremendously. So I don't know if that's correlation or causation, but still very proud of it.
But why were you willing to leave so soon?
You know, well, I stayed on for about 3.5 years.
Yeah, you sold it right away. That means you lost a lot of control.
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, I had a pretty great life up until maybe 3 months into Reddit when I learned that my mom had been diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. And this was something that I knew it was only a matter of time before life was going to catch up with me and slap me in the face. I just didn't think it would happen like that. And to have had role models like both of my parents who were as supportive as they were through all of that was amazing. I mean, literally the first words out of her mouth when I saw her the next day was, "I'm sorry." She, in the middle of dealing with all of that, was still thinking of me. And it's that kind of selflessness that I wanted to honor. And I wanted so desperately to show her that her support, my father's support, was not in vain. And so to get an opportunity to have my life changed, you know, at 23, 24 years old, like making that phone call to her is still and probably will always be my proudest moment, because I knew I could show her, like, "Look, Mom, like, you know, it was not in vain."
Well, normally I would consider it indiscreet to ask how much you got for selling it, but it's a matter of public record.
Yes. Well, you know, it's funny. The internet is very good at sussing these things out. I've never publicly said it myself, but if you Google around, you can find out. But it materially changed our lives. And yes, we were, you know, 20-something-year-old millionaires after that, which was pretty remarkable. And I know how lucky that was.
My guest is Alexis Ohanian. He has written a book called Without Their Permission, How the 21st Century Will Be Made, Not Managed. It's published by Business Plus, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Alexis Ohanian, O-H-A-N-I-A-N. His book, Without Their Permission, How the 21st Century Will Be Made, Not Managed, is published by Business Plus. And this book is as much a how-to guide as it is a memoir of a young, successful entrepreneur. What drives his success to help others harness the power of the internet? Well, you say to do good work, because there are plenty of people harnessing the internet to not do good work.
Absolutely. The thing that drives me is, at this point, selfishness. I get to meet founders every day who are building things that are going to make our lives better. I get to meet musicians who are making better art. I get to meet filmmakers who are working on better films. I am so fortunate because I get to watch this whole new wave of creatives, of entrepreneurs, of just amazing people, many of whom I'm profiling in the book, who are just making the world suck less in their own way because they're living up to their fullest potential. And that's awesome. How can you not like that?
Well, making the world suck less is a reminder that Google said, what, do not do evil?
Yes. Yeah,
and then people said, well, maybe they sometimes do evil.
Indeed.
Even though they say don't be evil.
My friend Paul Buchheit was actually the gentleman who coined that phrase when he was at Google, went on to also invent Gmail. And he's one of the mentors now at Y Combinator. So he has since left Google. I bet he probably has a few words for Larry and Sergey if they ever do meet up again. But so it goes.
You mentioned earlier that you advise and have invested in over 80 tech startups. What kind of advice do you give them?
This is going to sound a little disheartening, but my favorite advice to give them is that everything I'm about to tell you is wrong. Well, most of what I'm about to tell you is probably wrong. And it's to say that even as a quote-unquote expert, I still don't really know what I'm doing. I think all of us, if we're really honest with ourselves, will admit that, if we're not putting ourselves in situations where we're not feeling a little uncomfortable, we're probably not pushing ourselves hard enough. And so, you know, I meet with founders who are working on solving a particular problem. There's a startup called Flightcar that's doing peer-to-peer car rentals at the airport. So instead of going to Hertz, you just borrow my car, sort of like Airbnb for car rentals. I don't know that industry nearly as well as they do. Most of the people they will talk to, even the experts, don't know it as well as they do because they've focused on it. They've obsessed on it so much. And, you know,
but do you think sometimes they get too inside and lose the big picture?
It's true. It's true. And that's probably the 1% that I can really help with, which is when you do have someone from the outside. And one of the things I probably refer to too much, although there's no such thing, is how helpful it is to have people in your life. In my case, I use my girlfriend, Sabria, who can really be a kind of litmus test for any new idea, for any kind of thing, who can actually say to you candidly and honestly, that is a terrible idea. And so my role as an investor and an advisor is also to tell people, like, yeah, actually, I think that's not a great idea, and here's why. And that's not to bring them down. It's to help build them up.
Listeners have been writing in. One person writes, companies like Instagram don't actually make anything, and they don't employ all that many people, yet Facebook paid $1 billion for Instagram last year. Why are sites like that worth so much money?
Well, I mean, the glib answer is because someone's willing to pay for it. The longer-term answer, I think, for Facebook was simply that they were very quickly realizing how much people's attention was going to Instagram, and people were consuming photos. They saw it as a threat, and so Mark and everyone else realized that it was worth that price. And it is easy to look at things like that, to look at the acquisition of Tumblr by Yahoo for $1 billion.
But you said they saw it as a threat, so yeah. They're really buying out the potential competition?
Yeah, a company like Facebook, even 4 years ago, 3 years ago, was seen by many as being still kind of a novelty, like MySpace before it. And to their credit, you know, they've built a business that is, it is primarily through advertising, but it is making money. You know, the writer or the caller, the questioner, brings up a very good point, though. You know, software by its nature sort of makes efficiency by eliminating labor. And what I mean by that is, even if a developer sitting at her desk, she's going to write code for something that she has to do multiple times because the robot can do it easier than she can. And that's why it is so important that more and more of us are learning these skills, like writing code.
But we're seeing more and more of the big fish eating up the little fish. Mm. Or if we think of the old Westerns, the big rancher buying the small ranchers, mm-hmm. forcing the small rancher in some cases to sell. Is there still a wild, wild west aspect to the internet?
Well, that is a very loaded metaphor. There, it is not as lawless as the wild, wild west was, although I'm basing this all on Clint Eastwood movies, so bear with me.
There are no sheriffs, are there?
There's certainly still law enforcement, but there's an undoubtable frontier element to it. I sort of joke that in the book that I'm kind of like I'd like to be the Sacagawea for someone who's exploring this new frontier. There is undoubtedly, though, a quickness with which a new entrant, an upstart, a startup can quickly overtake an incumbent. And that's what gives me so much hope, is that the market is actually really vibrant and really healthy.
John from Long Island wants to know what someone who doesn't know how to code should do if they want to start an internet-based site or company. Should he simply learn to code himself or get in touch with people who can code?
Well, there is such amazing demand. Every company that I work with is hiring developers right now, which is it's a wonderful thing to say in this economy, but it tells you what the supply-demand looks like. The best bet really is, and you're never too old, like seriously, you can fire up Code Academy. There are so many free tutorials online, and all of the greats, whether it was my Reddit co-founder Steve Huffman or Mark Zuckerberg, they're all largely self-taught, which is an amazing thing about this skill, is that the resources are all actually freely available. That said, perhaps what you want to do is actually not quite building an app, but using existing ones. So look at Kickstarter, look at Etsy, look at these platforms that are letting people who are great with making jewelry to making films find their audience.
But it's also putting people out of business. Didn't your father's work in the travel business suffer because the internet made it possible for people to act as their own travel agents? I can't remember the last time I called a travel agent.
You should call it my dad. He is still in business.
Is he going to do something for me that I won't get from just going to Kayak?
Well, how much is Kayak going to actually tell you about your trip to Firenze? I'm someone who, you know, went on to help launch a travel search website called Hipmunk. So that was an awkward conversation with my father. But to his credit, he adapted his business, right? He started a travel agency in the middle of the first dot-com boom as everything was changing. Commissions were falling to zero. And I have so much respect for him because he didn't go try to lobby to Congress to change the rules like the entertainment industry does. He adapted his business. And so today he serves primarily a bunch of boomers taking their first cruises, as well as business travelers who just don't have the time or the interest in planning stuff themselves.
So let's talk about the entertainment business.
Oh, okay.
Do you see that as them and similar groups as the greatest threat to innovation in terms of the internet?
I think I am equally afraid of big business and big government, and that is largely historical. A gentleman and a friend of mine named Tim Wu wrote a fabulous book called The Master Switch, in which he talks about how so many of these communication platforms before the internet, radio, television, film, were all lauded for almost the exact same things. It's going to be democratic. It's going to allow anyone to have a voice. And it was some combination of ineptitude or greed from either business or government that ended up making them what they are today, which is anything but democratic.
And you've come out strongly in favor of open source. Mm-hmm. Can you briefly outline your argument there?
Sure. Well, it's a combination. You know, open source software, those are the giants whose shoulders we've been standing on. From a business standpoint, starting a website in the first boom was so expensive because all of the software cost a lot of money. Because of open source software, I can look an undergrad in the eyes and tell her, you can start a website right now and have it cost you less than your cell phone bill. And that's because of open source software, software written by very talented developers and essentially given away to the world. And that's fueled all of the innovation, really, for the last 10 years.
Well, isn't open source an open sore for people who rely on being paid for their work?
No. And here's what I would argue. You know, open source software is a perfect example of the rising tide lifting all boats, because by making more of this software available, this open source software that lets us start a website for virtually nothing, it's allowing more and more people to take that first step and be entrepreneurial and create that next platform, create that next thing, which itself ends up hiring all those new employees. I mean, if you look, you know, so much of the New York economy, and actually Mayor Bloomberg, to his credit, has been a huge supporter of it. We can't hire enough people right now. And every one of those companies that can't hire enough people in New York tech or anywhere in the country in tech are doing so on the backs of open source software.
Well, New York has been trying to make itself into a tech center.
Mm-hmm.
Are people moving here, or do you have to compete with Silicon Valley for people to just do a decent job?
You know, they have better burritos out west. That is the only thing I will concede. And I was made in Fort Greene, so I'm a little biased. But I actually left. I left San Francisco. I spent 3 months in Armenia, went back to the motherland for a little bit of volunteering. And then I moved back to New York because this is where I wanted to be. And in the last 3 years, many, many more founders have chosen to do so as well. And I'll tell you, a lot of it comes down to, would you rather live in New York City? I'll argue the greatest city on earth. Or would you rather live in the suburbs of Silicon Valley and have everything close at 10 p.m.?
And have a McMansion.
If you can afford it, right? The median rates, you can check this, the median rates of apartment rentals in San Francisco have now eclipsed New York's, which was staggering to see.
You've been very vocal in fighting against the anti-piracy movement as it relates to the Internet. Mm-hmm. And one example you point to is what you see as the disingenuousness of arguments put forth by the music industry in regard to Lester Chambers,
yes.
A member of the Chambers Brothers?
Yes.
People remember Time.
Of course, that cowbell. That was Lester. Yes, and we all have this song, right? I like to say my father raised me right. He raised me on the Stones, on Joplin, on Hendrix, and of course, the Chambers Brothers. And so we have this song in our heads, and it hit one Gold Records. It did very well, along with many others. And Lester simply never got paid. He was one of many artists who, unfortunately, during that period, was exploited and signed really bad deals. And it's so hard for me to hear the industry say, we are doing this, we are fighting piracy, quote-unquote, because of artists' rights, because all we care about is getting artists paid. And it's a pretty hard thing to swallow when you see artists like Lester Chambers saying, we have not been paid.
In fact, there are a lot of lawsuits. The guy with the Village People who says he didn't get paid for his songwriting, the writer of Money, That's What I Want, Barrett Strong, I think was mm-hmm. his name, he also claims that he was totally ripped off. Others were tricked into signing away their rights
mm-hmm.
and watch their songs become huge hits.
And it's appalling.
Never got anything for it.
Yeah, and so I lucked out because I saw Lester's, he had taken a photo of himself holding the gold record and it went viral on Reddit, and I reached out to him and all that's there in the book, and I was just so privileged to be able to work with him and help him get an album made that he actually owned.
But Alexis, yeah. Two wrongs don't make a right, because mm-hmm. some people have been dishonest in the record business doesn't mean that the people whose recordings are being pirated mm-hmm. aren't suffering as a result.
I think we continue to see more and more evidence. 2 weeks ago, the CEO of Netflix came out and said that after Netflix appeared in Canada, piracy dropped by 50%. You can throw that citation up. Like, we're seeing more and more evidence that shows there's actually not a relationship there between pirated sales and actually hurting artists or these companies. And I think what's more interesting to me is that there are executives right now who are doing very well in industries that are known for piracy. So I talked about Netflix. I could talk about the CEO of Valve, Gabe Newell.
Well, Netflix almost went under at one point, didn't it?
I mean, there was that, there
now
was that awful
done
decision
very well.
With Quickster. But, you know, it's funny. If you listen to Kevin Spacey from House of Cards talking at a recent conference just a couple weeks ago, he sounds like a tech entrepreneur. And he's saying all the right things because smart businesses and smart business leaders are realizing piracy is a service problem. If you can make it easier for anyone to give money for the content they want, they will do it. iTunes is an example. Netflix is an example. Steam is an example. And that's across three different major industries. And it's a classic scenario, right? My dad's sitting there telling me about the internet changing the travel industry. What does he do? He adapts his business.
In his latest book, Who Owns the Future, Jaron Lanier writes that the internet was supposed to be creating more opportunities and more wealth for the middle class, but that it hasn't actually done that. He points out that the creative class, especially musicians, journalists, and photographers, have been harmed in many ways by technology and the idea that content should be free. And he talks about things like Huffington Post, where people don't get paid for their work.
Well, I'd be very curious to see the data on this, if he has data supporting this, because there is so much happening right now that is still actually not really being categorized and quantified. I mean, look, here are some good numbers. Kickstarter delivered more money to artists this past year than the entire National Endowment for the Arts. Kickstarter is one website.
Unfortunately, that's sad about the National Endowment for the Arts.
It is. But as a sort of measuring stick, right? This thing, this platform, did not exist, I think, 4 years ago. And what I offer and what the book offers is this message of hope, which is we are already starting to see really positive signs, because I think we can all agree getting artists directly connected with their fans will lead to success. And getting them paid for it is a very big part of it. And there are things happening right now that are already helping make that happen.
We have very little time left, but I had to ask you, what is Bread Pig?
Bread Pig is a pig with bread wings, and the mascot that I use and doodle throughout with this book, as well as a sidekick hero for hire. We help about a dozen artists with their Kickstarter campaigns, and we've launched, in fact, our most successful project on Kickstarter was a choose-your-own-adventure version of Hamlet called To Be or Not to Be by an author named Ryan North. How much money do you think he raised for that book? What kind of an advance would you give him for that?
I have no idea.
He raised over $600,000.
Alexis Ohanian has been called the mayor of the internet by Forbes and a titan of tech by Wired magazine. His book is called Without Their Permission, How the 21st Century Will Be Made, Not Managed. It is published by Business Plus, and I want to thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you so much, Leonard.
On tomorrow's show, New York Times Social Cues columnist Philip Galanis takes your calls and questions about pet etiquette and how to gracefully handle sticky situations with Fido and his owner. And then the director of a documentary about the tragic 1985 standoff between the radical group MOVE and the Philadelphia Police Department. Also, Tash Awe on his latest novel, Five Star Billionaire, which captures the vibrancy of Shanghai today. We'll find out why, despite an international ban, the ivory trade continues and is targeting young elephants for their valuable tusks, plus a look at the science of cloud seeding and how being able to make it rain could help in the fight against drought and crop failure. Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Julia Corcoran, and Jessica Miller. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Daughtry is at the audio controls. We had help today from Matthew McDonough, Todd McGovern, and Akita Sood. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.